Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's November 2021, and this is episode 260, which is a conversation about answering the question, does the Bible teach women can be ordained pastors? On this episode, I'm joined by Matthew Kennedy, who has an MDiv and is the rector, aka senior pastor, of the Church of the Good Shepherd, an Anglican church in Binghamton, New York. He also writes for the Anglican blog, Stand Firm. Matt has written a feature article in the print edition of the Christian Research Journal in volume 44, number 3, and his article is called Christ and His Bride, Why Your Pastor's Gender Matters. It is available for free at our website, equip.org, to all of our subscribers. And if you're not already a subscriber and would like to read Matt's in-depth article answering this question, please subscribe to the Christian Research Journal at equip.org. Matt, it's good to have you on.
It's great to be here.
Well, this is a topic that there are very two distinct views, a complementarian one and an egalitarian one, and there's been many, many books, both academic and lay, that have lay level books that have been published on this subject for many decades. But again, even though that's true, you know, there's just always a lot of questions that we receive at the Christian Research Institute just about what women's role in the church in terms of the ordained roles does the Bible really speak to? And so that's always a question that we get, you know, can women be ordained as a minister to serve the sacraments in their local church? So, you know, one thing that is true is that Genesis in chapter 1, it talks about both men and women in their essence. They're both made in the image of God. And so they're equally image bearers of God. And so sometimes that's referenced as because in our essence, we are equal. We don't have a distinction as far as being made in the image of God and reflecting His image, that women and men should have equal roles in the church and also in marriage. And so I think also another thing that's in the context of that, as we just kind of set the stage for this discussion, is, you know, people will say, well, it's a little bit different in the New Testament because Paul talks about in Ephesians that as Christians, we're supposed to mutually submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And so there is no longer this issue of submission, not only in marriage, but also as Christians, we mutually submit to one another. And so there really shouldn't be any kind of hierarchy in terms of roles that men and women can have within the church in terms of authority in church structures.
That's the assertion, and I think it, you know, of course, we want to definitely affirm that men and women are equally made in God's image. There's an ontological equality or an equality of being or essence. There's a man is not more human than a woman, and a woman is not more human than a man. We're both equally human. That's precisely and exactly right. The question would be, what are the implications of that? I mean, does that necessarily mean, therefore, that our roles must therefore be identical, or at least that all roles in the church, or all ministries in the church, and all positions within marriage, I guess the relationship in marriage, should be one of pure equality? And I think that, I think just backing up from that particular question, I think we already know that just an equality of essence doesn't necessarily require an equality of role. We know that just from everyday life. When I was in basic training, my drill sergeant made it very clear that I was not in an equal role with him, even though we were both ontologically equal. He was a human being and I was a human being, but he made it very clear, and I agreed. He was in that position, in that place, in that particular context, my superior, and I had to submit to him. So just in a basic level, I think we all understand that within certain contexts, submission to someone who is your ontological equal, part of being human and living in society. And I guess the argument is, or the question is, does the Bible teach that within the particular context of marriage and in the particular context of the church, is there a hierarchy in which the male is called to lead and the female is called to submit? And I would argue that that idea is shot through the scriptures beginning in Genesis and going all the way through Revelation.
But I think some people would say there's certain things about the Bible for, you know, all of us that believe the Bible is the word of God and it's true and we believe that it has authority, that there are certain things that in the Bible were cultural that we don't do today. And so, you know, some of those things, can they apply also to just the kind of roles that men and women have? That things are different now in the 21st century than they were during the time when Jesus lived or even before that in the Old Testament, the time of the patriarchs. And so would we necessarily apply those same ways in which, you know, maybe women were viewed today as they were, you know, it's different. Wouldn't we make a different application of those verses?
And that is a common argument that Paul in the New Testament was speaking out of his cultural prejudice when he called wives to submit to husbands. But if you just taking Ephesians 5 as an example, where he does command that and commands that husbands love their wives, he's grounding that argument not in any kind of cultural phenomena. He actually grounds that in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, where he quotes God saying, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And Paul says this is about or refers to Christ and his church. And so what that means is he's predicated his command to the wife to submit to her husband on the creation order of the relationship between Christ and his church, which is the reason that the typology is the reason why God made us male and female in the first place. Paul is in no way saying, hey, Roman culture is this way, we should be this way. He's saying God created male and female and joined them together in marriage so that they could reflect Christ and his church in their relationship. And Christ and his church are not in an egalitarian relationship. The church submits to Christ, and Christ is the Lord of the church, and Christ gives his life for the church, and the church gives her honor and respect and obedience to Christ.
You just mentioned the word typology, so I want to reference your article. As I mentioned, Matt has a feature article in the print edition of volume 44, number 3, and we're talking about the topic of, you know, why, as I mentioned, that gender is a factor in the roles that men and women have in terms of ordained roles. So in your article, you discuss types and typology. So why don't you mention that word? So why don't you explain to our listeners, what is typology?
A type is a picture. It's a portrait. God uses various pictures and portraits of his son and the work of his son in the Old Testament. So one classic might be David. You know, David steps forward to fight Goliath. And the Israelites who have been gathered together to fight the Philistines are afraid and they don't want to fight him. And Saul even is afraid, doesn't want to fight Goliath. And the Philistines are mocking. And here comes David. He's the hero. He steps forward. No one would expect him to be able to defeat Goliath because he looks so plain, so common, so small. Of course, he's ruddy and handsome, I guess, but he seems to be no match for Goliath, and yet he slays him. That's a type of Christ who steps forward to do battle with sin and with Satan and to just defeat our enemies for us. There's numerous pictures like that in the scriptures. In fact, if you read the Old Testament in light of the gospel, in light of what we know about Jesus, about what God has done in the New Testament through Jesus, then you'll find that if you're looking for them, that these types just pop out all over the place. And in particular, the type that we're dealing with probably in this broadcast is not one that you really have to even look for, because it's one that the Apostle Paul draws out specifically when he mentions that the joining together of Adam and Eve in the garden was about or referred to Christ and his church. That's not something that we have to, that we make up. That's not a type that we have to find or discover. That's one that the apostle himself identified.
So why is this issue of typology important when we're talking about the relationships between men and women in marriage, both in marriage and in the church? And in particular, you know, talking about Adam and Eve as a type in the garden in Genesis.
Well, it's important because in a marriage, when Jesus is talking about marriage in Matthew chapter 19, he goes right back to that Genesis 2, joining together of Adam and Eve. And he makes that marriage, that joining together, constitutive of all marriages. He says that this is the model, this is the type, this is the what God does when any man and any woman come together in marriage. He does the same thing that he did with Adam and Eve. He joins them together. And so when Paul, going back to the same text, says it's about Christ and his church, that tells us that the purpose for any marriage, regardless of where it is, the purpose of any marriage is to tell a story, the gospel about Christ and his church. That's why it's important, again, that the husband give himself over for the wife, and that the wife submits to the husband, because you tell that story accurately. You don't want to lie about that story. You don't want to say something that's not true. So a husband cheating on a wife would tell the lie that Christ is unfaithful to his bride, which is not true, and a bride disrespecting and dishonoring her husband would say, or distrusting him would say, well, the church doesn't trust Christ, which is also a lie. It helps us see the meaning inherent in our own marriages. We are talking about the gospel, not just about our own relationships with one another, but we're talking about the gospel. So it's marriage is a much larger thing than just two people getting together because they're attracted to one another or because they want to have children. I would argue, and I did argue in this paper, that the same thing is true in relationship to the people that God appoints as leaders of his people. So I mentioned in the article that Adam acts as prophet, priest, and king in the garden, and in his relationship to the garden itself, and in his relationship to Eve. And those three offices are carried forward into the old covenant. They're distributed in Adam. They're all together in his person. He acts as a priest in the garden. He acts as a prophet with Eve, since he has to pass on the command that God gave him to her. And he acts as king, exercising dominion and naming the beasts and even the woman. Those offices are distributed in the old covenant. So you have a priesthood, a Levitical priesthood that's all male. You have a kingship that's male. You do have some examples of female, or two really badly negative examples of queens, Athalia and Jezebel. But the kings are the kings of Judah, the descendants of David, are all male. And then you have mostly male prophets. There are some exceptions, but mostly male prophets. Those three offices are distributed, and they're relating to the people of God. And you know, in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant, God calls himself the husband of Israel, the divine suitor of Israel, and he speaks to his bride through the priests, the prophets, and the kings. That's how he leads them. Jesus comes along, and of course, he brings all of those three offices to fulfillment, and he accomplishes them perfectly. So whereas Adam failed, and the kings of Israel failed, and the priests failed, and the prophets, they accurately preached God's word, but the Israel still didn't heed them. Jesus succeeds. He fulfills all three offices perfectly for the bride, for the people of God. And he accomplishes our salvation. But what does he do? He establishes a new covenant church, and he appoints leaders. First, he appoints the apostles, the male apostles, and the apostles, through the apostles, he raises up elders/overseers or presbyters, through whom our prophet, priest, and king relates to his church. And so the church itself, with a male presbyter or a male overseer/elder, elders leading the church, also is telling a story about Christ and his bride, about Christ and his love for his church, that goes all the way back to the garden.
Well, there are people, though, that would refute that and say that there are plural verb forms in Genesis 1 and that, yes, both male and female were created in God's image and that the, you know, cultural mandate that was given to them is shared and they don't have a divided responsibility and it's not given just to Adam. And so therefore, thinking that males have headship over women is not really in the original context of Genesis. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's kind of interesting. First of all, of course, Adam is created sequentially first. And he is given the authority to name the animals. He names them as he would have. God gives him that authority. And then when Eve is created, she's created from his body. So she's both, and this is very much like the church, she's both his body and his bride. And Adam even names her before she's on the scene, before God takes her out of Adam's body. God gives Adam the command regarding the tree, you ought to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And there's no repetition of that command, to Eve. So the implication is, of course, that Adam has to communicate that command to his wife and teach her how to obey it. After the fall, when the serpent approaches Eve and tempts her, and she takes the fruit, and it turns out, I think it's in verse six of chapter three, that Adam's right there with her. I remember watching a cartoon when I was a kid that, you know, Adam was off, you know, collecting bananas or something while the serpent was tempting his wife. No, he was right there. And it's interesting that when God comes looking for the couple after they have sinned, he calls Adam to account first. Even though it was Eve who took the fruit, even though it was Eve who ate first, it's Adam who is held responsible for it. And that also is shot through the scriptures. I mean, Paul says that in Romans chapter 5, that that we've all sinned in Adam. It's Adam's sin that doomed us. And why is that? Well, because he's the one responsible. He was the one who is the head of that unit of Adam and Eve. He was the head of his wife, and he did not intervene and protect her from the serpent. And he followed her into the sin that she committed. So all of that together, I think, dispels the idea that there was this kind of egalitarian paradise in Eden. It was certainly paradise, but it was a non-abusive, non-tyrannical, loving relationship between a husband and wife that was, in fact, hierarchical.
If you've been listening to this podcast lately, you know that we're running a contest for free subscription to the Christian Research Journal. And how you enter is really simple. You go to Apple Podcasts, you search for Postmodern Realities, and we ask that you give us a starred review. Or if you want to enter the contest, which will end on December 31st, 2021, you would write us a very brief one or two sentence comment about why you listen to this podcast. And I want to thank Joe so much. He did write us a comment in the last several weeks. And so far, we've got two people entered into the contest. So your odds are very good for you winning if you go ahead and do that. And it helps us out because it helps people find our content. So we thank you for that. In addition, if you want to read Matt's article where he unpacks what the Bible has to say about if women can be ordained ministers, then you want to get this exclusive online content, please subscribe to our journal. You can do that at our website, equip.org. It's $33.50. Another way you can help us out is simply just tell friends about this podcast and link your favorite episodes on your social media accounts. And another way that you can help us out to meet our budget to pay our amazing writers is to give us a tip. And you can do that at our website, equip.org. If you go to the magazine tab at the dropdown, you'll see Postmodern Realities, and you can just hit that, go to any of the landing pages or your favorite episodes are, and then you can click on the link that will take you to give us a tip. And thank you for partnering with us.
So you describe in your article Adam as a prophet, priest, and king in the Garden of Eden, and Eden itself as a kind of temple, and you trace these three offices all the way through the New Testament to Christ, who fulfills those offices. So how does that relate to the question of the roles of men and women in the church?
Sure. I mean, I also argue that when the Apostle Paul leaves for the church the qualifications for presbyters, for the elder slash overseer, who would be the one who would be leading a congregation, that those specifications indicate a male leadership, males in those particular offices. And so that fits well with this idea of Christ exercising his ministry of prophet, priest, and king to his church through those male leaders he's appointed. And the male leaders are typologically relating to the church like Christ does. So I think the argument that you might hear from, or you will hear from egalitarians, is that the two places directly where presbyters are, the office of presbyters ascribed, that would be 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1, don't necessarily require males to fulfill those offices. However, if you read, I think it's a very difficult argument to make. The presbyter is supposed to be the husband of one wife, or a one woman man. It's a good way of saying that. The word for man or male there is specifically one that's used almost always for male, not just man or like humankind, but male. Paul has in mind, it seems very clearly, a male presbyterate. Some have said, it's a kind of interesting argument, they'll say that also in 1 Timothy, I think it's in chapter 5, Paul uses a similar phrase to describe widows who are receiving help from the church, and he calls them one men women or one husband wives. Their husbands have died, and the point there he's trying to make is they've been faithful to their husbands. And so say, well, look, since Paul uses a similar phrase to describe widows, you can't make too much of an argument out of one woman man in 1 Timothy 3. But I think it actually, I think the fact that he switches the order of the words actually does make the point. Paul knows very well that there are not male widows. And so he says widows have to be the former women of one man. And he knows very well that presbyters can't be women. So he says they have to be one woman men. So I think that 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 indicate pretty clearly that the apostle assumed and understood that there would be male leadership in the church. And I think that the reason for that is typological, again, they're reflective of the love of the divine husband for his bride.
But the Old Testament, I mean, throughout the Bible, it talks about women are in positions of leadership. For example, the Old Testament, talks about the leadership of Deborah in the book of Judges. She was a female judge. She was also a prophetess. And, women play important roles in the New Testament. In fact, it's, obvious that it was in the word, it talks about, there was a woman, Mary, who was the first witness of the resurrection, not the disciples who were in hiding. And then also in Paul's ministry, there was the Apostle Paul, there was Phoebe and Lydia, Junia, Priscilla, and all of those women seemed to hold important leadership positions in the early church. And so what about all the ways in which the Bible is showing women in leadership positions in terms of actually in the church or in the, religious community, like in Judges?
I mean, I think the argument, there's several arguments there. One is one from pragmatism. So women can do these kinds of jobs, and we see them doing, similar jobs as a presbyter, preaching in certain ways and leading in certain ways in the pages of the scriptures. So why shouldn't we just make them presbyters? The problem is, of course, you have two specific texts that describe what a presbyter is supposed to do and who a presbyter is supposed to be, and those texts are pretty clearly, as I said a minute ago, describing males. So that a woman, no, I don't think anyone denies. I certainly don't deny. I don't think anybody who's on the complementarian side of this thing denies that that in many cases women can be better speakers than men. Women can be better leaders than men in various contexts. Women are certainly have and should have places of influence and authority in the church. Those are truths, but those truths are beside the point. The point is, who has God called to be the presbyter? And because the specific texts which deal with that question identify males as presbyters, the fact that women can do certain things is somewhat irrelevant. And I think the typological picture that I've been pointing to earlier throughout this talk explains why, even though a woman might be able to preach a better sermon than a man, why you'd still want the male to be the primary preacher, because of that typological picture of Christ and his bride, which a woman being the primary leader of a congregation would distort and obscure. So I think the typological point is helpful here in explaining why the pragmatic argument doesn't quite work in this. Now, you do point out some examples of women who had some important roles and influence, both in the Old Testament and in the New. I mean, it's true that women were the first ones to announce the resurrection. They announced it to the male apostles. The women were with Jesus at the crucifixion and at his death and at his burial. And I think only John was the only man who stuck around for those. So you certainly have women showing initiative and caring for Jesus and also proclaiming the resurrection. You have women playing prominent roles in the church. You have Lydia, who is a seller of purple dye, who is a prominent supporter of Paul, and probably the church in Philippi met in her house. You mentioned Phoebe, who's maybe a deacon. We're not quite sure. The word that's used to describe her could describe the office of deacon, or it could just be servant. But she carries she's probably the one who carries the letter that Paul wrote to the Roman church through her. She's described as the patroness, someone who was a benefactor of the church, and probably one of the churches met in her house as well. You have Junia, who I think some spuriously claim was an apostle, capital A. Most likely she was maybe among the people who were functioning as church emissaries and people who were charged with extending the reach of the church. And that's the lower A apostle, sent ones. But not much is said about her. It was really hard to know much about her at all, except that she was well known among or in or by the apostles. I'm not quite sure exactly how to translate that phrase. And then you mentioned Priscilla, who certainly corrected, along with her husband Aquila, Apollos, when he was teaching and what didn't quite have the full understanding of the gospel, and she took him aside and taught him. But none of these really address the point. I mean, of course, women are have the ability to teach men things. My goodness, of course, women are human. It's like we are. So of course they can teach us things. The idea that men should be presbyters and women shouldn't means that women can't teach or can't hold authority or can't do any kind of, have any kind of influential role in the church is not something, not a point that I would make, or I don't know, I can't think of any complementarian who would make that point. Those texts just show that women should be accorded honor, respect, and given ministries and all kinds of things in the church. It's just the narrow question we're dealing with is whether they should be presbyters. As for Deborah, and there were some female prophets in the Old Testament too. God used women to speak to his people under the Old Covenant. There may have been some female prophetesses in the New Testament. But again, we're talking about here the specific office of presbyter, who holds the role who has the official office of leadership in the church. And I think the New Testament is pretty clear that it's a male. And the reason, again, I think is pretty clear too, because of that typological portrait that God's painting.
So, you know, you've mentioned presbyter several times. So what specifically is the role of the elder, overseer, or as you say, presbyter in the New Testament? And is there anything in the New Testament description that a woman could not also fulfill? I mean, some people would argue that, there are different forms of church government, but in the forms of church government that do have laity that are involved as elders, for example, I think they would say, you know, women need to be equally represented and men can't really fully relate to some of the spiritual issues that women need. What about women who might be in an abusive situation or something like that? They need women, godly women, who can serve in those elder type roles that are spiritually mature. How would you just answer some of those concerns that people have and why they would want to have female presbyters?
I can certainly understand, and I think it's right, that in certain contexts you need women to help other women. I mean, you know, especially in situations you name, like abuse situations, you want to elevate women and keep them in places of influence, and especially when there are issues that a man may not be able to understand as well as a woman can. You want a woman in there to help. But again, I think that's not quite relevant to the question of the office of presbyter. What are some things that a presbyter, how is it that a presbyter is described in ways that really a woman can't fulfill? And, you know, well, I mentioned already one, that the husband of one wife or a one woman man, but also in the verse 3, for example, there's this line in verses 4 and 5, he must manage his own household well with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? Now, in our day and time, you might think very little of that, but in the first century, those requirements really couldn't be met by a woman. Only a man could have the ability, the cultural, social clout to make sure to manage his own household well and keep his children submissive. A woman, a wife, wouldn't have that kind of authority, so you couldn't hold her to that responsibility. So the fact that requirement's even there indicates that Paul has in mind a male authority, not female authority, because if he had female authority, this wouldn't be a fair requirement. They couldn't do that. They couldn't ensure the full management of their household. Only the head of a household can do that. The practical necessities of ministry in a church, of course, you want women, you need women to be part and parcel of that. The narrow question, again, that we're dealing with is the question of the presbyter. His role is, of course, to lead the church in an official way in the name of Christ. He also, Titus tells us that in addition to the moral requirements, that he be someone who's not a drunkard, not violent, someone who's gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money, not a drunkard. But he also should be able to teach and also be able to refute those who would teach falsely. So it has to be someone who's able and willing to stand up to false teaching. That's not, I mean, I don't think that only men are able to do that at all. I'm just saying those are some of the things that the presbyter is called to do, and be a protector, kind of a shepherd. And Peter elsewhere calls or refers to the elder as a shepherd of the flock, an under shepherd under the great shepherd.
We talked about this a little earlier on in the podcast, but I mean, again, couldn't it be said that the Apostle Paul and the other apostles during that time of the early church, you know, were just expressing realities or familial realities of their time, and that these recommendations that they give or the requirements that they give for presbyters really were out of their own, you know, cultural maybe prejudices or patriarchy or you know, it's not really a reflection of now, 21st century. In other words, even in terms of marriage, there are now households, you know, not just in the Western world, but basically worldwide, where there's single mothers who are the heads of their households. And some of those single mothers that we find in our church are very godly women with a lot of maturity. And so weren't those kinds of, you know, requirements made out of their own culture and what they knew at the time that marriage was, you know, between a man and a woman in this kind of nuclear family that is not necessarily true of the majority of people now?
Yeah, the reason I mentioned the requirement that a man be able to the presbyter be able to manage his own household well was not to to say the culture doesn't change. The point was that Paul envisioned a male presbyter, and to have the who to even articulate those conditions would necessarily mean that that's what he was intending to have, what he was intending, the male presbyter. So yeah, the fact that the culture has changed since that time is an important fact. We have to recognize that and realize that when we apply the scriptures to our day, we need to recognize the scripture that the times have changed. But the question we need to ask is twofold. One, what is the basis upon which Paul establishes roles for men and women? And invariably what we find is the basis upon which he establishes these roles is the creation order. We see that in Ephesians 5 in particular. We see it in various places when Paul talks about women of the church. In 1 Corinthians 11, for example, he talks about the woman being deceived, the man not being deceived. His whole idea is not to reflect his culture, but to say, okay, now that Christ has come and redeemed us, redeemed creation, now we can live in accordance with the Edenic model. We can recapture the original way that God made us, and so he's actually transcending his own culture and providing these models for us. Secondly, you know, the to say that the culture has changed and to say that Paul was a man of his culture, also you don't want to obscure the fact that that being the case, he is also an apostle. And what we know about apostles is that when they taught, Christ taught through them. When the scriptures that we have are not just historical artifacts. Paul's letters are not just first century documents. They are first century documents, but they're not just first century documents. They're also theopneustos. They're God-breathed documents. So we should be very reticent about saying, well, this was written at this time. We no longer think the things they thought of at this time, so let's throw them over. God chose that time to inspire Paul to write what he wrote. So we should be very careful about relegating those things to the past. They are eternal. When God gives a command, when God reveals things, when God breathes out his word, those are eternal words, which should be understood that way, and not just thrown over because times have changed.
But in Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, it says this: there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. So isn't Paul saying in that verse that because of Christ, because of the gospel, there isn't any distinction between male or female? That happened because of the fall, and now Christ has redeemed that. So there is no longer any need for any kind of hierarchy in the church based on gender, because that's been redeemed by Christ.
It's interesting that text is dealing with justification. What has to happen in order for a person to be justified and received and reconciled to God? And in that sense, there's no distinction, right? Male, female, slave, free. No one. I mean, we are all sinners. We're all ontologically in the image of God. We're all sinners, and so there is no distinction. We are all one before the cross. That's the case. To take that idea and apply it to church offices or to marriage in particular is a miscategorization. It's a misapplication of that text. That text isn't talking about marriage or church offices or church polity. It's talking about our equality before the cross and before God, which no one denies. If you want to talk about marriage or church offices, you would want to go to the texts that deal with marriage or church offices. And we go to Ephesians 5, we can go to Colossians 3 to talk about marriage. We can go to 1 Timothy 3. We can go to Titus 1 to talk about the offices of the church. There are people who take that, though. There's what's called the trajectory argument, where they'll take Galatians chapter 3, and they'll kind of say what you were saying earlier. You were articulating earlier as the opposing argument, the egalitarian argument. They'll say, well, Paul is speaking from a time in which women were seen as less than, and yet at the same time in Galatians 3, he envisions a time when there's no more less than. And so the trajectory of the New Testament is one of liberation, which means that ultimately there should be no more hierarchy. That should all be done away with. And so even though we have these kind of set parameters in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, those are going to wither away over time, and we're going to be able to establish an egalitarian system. The problem with that is it kind of cuts against the idea I was mentioning a minute ago, which is there's no sense of that in the scriptures. There's no sense. That's a theory built off of an assumption about Galatians 3 that's not quite true, since it's talking about justification and not church offices or roles. It's a theory built off a presupposition, really, that isn't grounded in the scriptures. The best way to read the scriptures is since they've been given to us by God, the final deposit of Christ's teaching to his church, we should take those as sufficient for everything, for our lives together as husbands and wives, and for our life together in the church. If we say there's still some kind of development going on, more revelation coming to us, then we've got very serious problems with just about every doctrine that we have in the scriptures. So what else is going to be seen in a trajectory standpoint? And in fact, those who argue for gay marriage and same-sex relationships would also use the very same argument of trajectory. Yeah, well, Paul was speaking out of his limited cultural framework when he forbade those things, but now we know more, and so we can apply Galatians 3 to sexual relationships outside of marriage between two men or two women, and see that really, in fact, the liberation idea counts for them also.
But it seems to me that lately, the last several years, there have just been so many. I mean, explain to us what you mean by submission in marriage, and that there's a hierarchy in marriage, because it seems to me that there have been revelations that within the Christian church, that people have used that doctrine to very much abuse women and to take advantage of them. And so what does that even mean practically? It seems to me that women do make a lot of decisions in their families and their marriage. And so does that mean they don't have any voice in their own marriage or the decisions that their family makes? What does it mean to submit? Why would women need to do that within a marriage?
It's kind of funny. If you look at the Ephesians 5 again, Paul doesn't say to husbands, make sure your wives submit to you. That's not the command. And then he doesn't say, wives, make sure your husbands love you. The command isn't for the husband to force anything or to make anything happen. The command is to the wife, and it's a voluntary. You play the role of the church in this relationship for the purpose of preaching about the church. So I say the first answer to that question is the man, it's not up to him to force anything or to make his wife submit. That's not his role. He's not commanded ever to do that. This was a direct command from the apostle to the wife. Secondly, I mean, I think submission is often portrayed in terms of like almost a militaristic obedience, and that it's an inhuman way of looking at it, and it's not quite the way it ever works out. I think the idea is basically one of partnership in which two people who are equals in humanity and equally justified by God and through Jesus Christ live life together, part of I think I've used this example in other contexts, but part of hopefully being a good husband is recognizing where you need help, where you're bad at certain things. So we knew this. We met this couple once, and they were in ministry, and I won't name the particular ministry because it might identify the couple and I would get them in trouble, but. It wasn't preaching or teaching or anything like that, but it was a ministry. And it turns out that the woman was very much better at it than the man was. And the man was really good in the kitchen. He was a great cook, kept the house well. But they had this idea that to really apply Ephesians 5 to our marriage, the husband has to do the work outside the home. The ministry outside the home, and the wife has to be in the kitchen. And so we were visiting them, and we just had the horrible soup. This awful, awful meal. It was awful because she cooked it, and she's not a great cook. And he never really was able to be effective in the ministry that he was given. So what would you do in a situation like that? Well, I mean, I would say, okay, look, why don't you say, hey, honey, look, you're better at this than I am. Why don't you do this, and I'll sit in the kitchen? And that would be a perfectly fine way of exercising, Christ-like leadership in a family, and the wife could, submit to her husband by actually doing the work that's, I guess, culturally seen as, in some cases, male, masculine task. I think what happens, unfortunately, when we in the modern era try to apply Ephesians 5 or Colossians 3 to our marriages, is that we take cultural ideas of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, and we just kind of align those too much with the application of those texts, when I don't think those are necessary. I do think there's a general sense of what it is to be masculine and feminine, of course, but I think it's too often that we take our cultural norms and just kind of glom them on to biblical commands.
And what about ability? I mean, you just mentioned in that example, the woman in the ministry had better skills and then her husband had better skills in the domestic area. So, there's some women who are better public speakers than men. There's some that are very skilled and gifted in speaking and understanding scripture, specifically women who have gone to seminary. And they have MDivs, and so they've been through all the languages, Greek and Hebrew. They understand those. And some women have very good leadership skills, I mean, better than some men do. And so, if women can do these roles as well or even better than men, shouldn't they be able to exercise those gifts in the church? Doesn't it limit the ways in which women can exercise their gifts in the church? I mean, even Paul talks about, right, that he's given some to be teachers and apostles and all these kinds of things, leaders. And so there are women with these leadership skills and they're very good at teaching. And so shouldn't the body of Christ benefit from the gifts that God has given them?
Oh, absolutely. The example I was using just a minute ago, what didn't have to do with being a presbyter, it had to do with a certain other different kind of ministry. Again, I can't name it sadly, without identifying the people. But I do think, of course there's definitely room for some practical considerations. Who does this better? Who's able to do this and who's not able to do that? But when we're talking about the actual office, the office of presbyter, overseer, elder, because we have specific commands dealing with that office And because we have, I think, the typology of Christ and his bride shot through the scriptures that applies to it, I think there our practical considerations need to fall away because we're not dealing at that point with something practical. I mean, we're dealing with something typological, we're dealing with something theological. And so the picture of the gospel needs to take precedence over who's a better speaker or who's a better leader. It's the same thing in a marriage. I mean, it might be that a husband is in certain cases just not up to snuff, as far as his leadership goes, and he may not ever recognize that. Does that mean that the wife doesn't have to submit to him, or that he shouldn't take leadership where he can? Of course, it doesn't matter. He's still the specific commands dealing with a marriage relationship are still in play. My earlier example was just saying that a man can, as a leader of the family, so arrange it so that his wife's skills are brought to the fore. But even that wouldn't remove the command that we have specifically for marriage, that the wife should submit to the husband and the husband should love the wife as Christ loved the church.
Issue, just everyone that is interested in it debates it. It just goes around and around and around. It just doesn't seem to have any particular resolution to it, except for you're on one side or the other. I mean, why is this particular question about women being ordained in the church particularly important for us now?
Well, I think a lot of the social changes that we've seen taking place in the last century and in this one probably lie at the heart of this. There is a sense in which nowadays people tend to analyze social relationships through the grid of oppressor oppressed, and so the analysis of marriage, the analysis of the church, run through that grid of oppressor oppressed, tries to see through things like the command that we have in Ephesians 5 and say, no, it really isn't about theology. This is just about power. And so let's equalize the power. And that goes all ultimately back to, some kind of the insights of Marx. Marx was one who would say everything is really about power. And, I'll give an example I used recently in another talk is, for the Marxists, there's no such thing as beauty. No such thing as like the beautiful countryside or beautiful landscape. You're just trained to think of the land as beautiful because doing so will preserve it in the hands of those who own it, and it won't be developed for the people. So if you can just see through the beauty to the power differential, you'll say, oh, no, this isn't beautiful land. This is an economic entity that needs to be exploited for the people and taken out of the hands of the powerful. I think that analysis which was once narrowly Marxist, has been extrapolated in the modern era through various critical theories and has infected the church in many ways, subtle and not so subtle, so that now any hierarchy is viewed in that kind of cynical way. This is really about power. So how do we undo the power differential and raise up the quote unquote oppressed? I think that's why now, in the last two or three years, quote unquote, wokeness has taken such precedent in the West and even in the church in particular, that's why we're having just a renewed heat, with regard to this question. People have Christians have begun to acquiesce to, and I think conform to this idea that underneath everything is this power differential, this oppressor oppressed binary.
Well, on a much lighter note, I have some fun rapid fire questions for Matt so we can get to know our authors better. Matt, it's officially fall right now. Are you team pumpkin or team apple?
I am team pumpkin.
And in addition to theology, what do you know well enough that you could teach to other people?
Lord of the Rings.
And besides God, family, and friends, of course, what's the best thing in your life right now?
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. I guess church.
Well, thanks, Matt, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you. It's been great.
You've been listening to episode 260 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Matt Kennedy. He has written an article in our print issue, volume 44, number 3 of the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Christ and His Bride, Why Your Pastor's Gender Matters. All of our subscribers can read it for free at our website, equip.org. And again, if you're not already a subscriber and would like to read Matt's in-depth article, please subscribe to the journal at equip.org.